WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. On April Fool's Day, a long-running cat-and-mouse game between U.S. surveillance aircraft and Chinese fighter jets ended in a collision off the Chinese coast. A Chinese pilot was killed. The U.S. plane and its crew became the center of an international incident after they were forced to make an emergency landing at a Chinese airfield. It's the latest in a long series of such incidents over the past half century, most involving the old Soviet Union. There's a black granite wall at the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland, with a motto carved on it: "They served in silence." A list follows with the names of 152 U.S. military and civilian personnel who died on eavesdropping missions. Writer James Bamford exposed a great deal about the United States' biggest, most expensive, and most secretive intelligence service in a book called The Puzzle Palace in 1982. He's now written an anatomy of the NSA titled Body of Secrets. James Bamford joins us in the studio in Washington. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Neil. It's good to be here.
I want to ask you about this most recent incident, but in fact, you report something much more startling in Body of Secrets, a mission that President Eisenhower authorized in 1956.
That's right. It was probably the most dangerous, probably the most foolish espionage operation ever undertaken. President Eisenhower in 1956 authorized this operation Home Run, which basically gave the U.S. Air Force permission to launch U.S. bombers on a what basically is an attack profile over the North Pole and into past the borders and right into the Soviet Union.
And the last of these involved a flight of six bombers in formation over the North Pole deep into the old Soviet Union in broad daylight.
That's right, flying almost wingtip to wingtip, which is exactly the profile you would have if you were launching World War III. This was not a bombing run. It was a reconnaissance run. The planes were not loaded with bombs. They were loaded with cameras and eavesdropping equipment. But anybody in Russia who happened to see them coming over the horizon and coming over the pole and into Russian airspace would have no way of knowing that there's cameras instead of H-bombs in their bomb bay. So anybody that saw them on a radar screen would have immediately thought that this was the prelude to a new nuclear war and could have launched a counterattack against the United States.
In retrospect, it seems insane. What would even conceivably make such an operation worth the risk?
Well, the reason they did it was they wanted to know whether that was going to be a safe route in case the U.S. did launch a nuclear war against Russia. That would be the route we would fly our bombers, and the reason they did that was to see whether there were any radar installations or any military bases in that path. And then if there was, then they would try to pick an alternative avenue to come into the Soviet Union, find a hole in their border defenses, basically. Luckily, that was a hole, and luckily there was no counterattack.
But there were other incidents where bombers or adapted bombers were sent into the Soviet airspace frequently over the border as an outright provocation. The idea was to startle the Russians, make them turn on all their radars, and then get intelligence on all of it.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, we did it very frequently, and it was a very aggressive, very in-your-face type of intelligence collection. It was sending, and this is before the days of the U-2 reconnaissance plane, which flew at very high altitudes and was unarmed. These were our highest quality bombers that we were sending in. They were they had no nuclear weapons on, but they did have defensive weapons, machine guns and cannons and so forth. There was no counterpart on the Russian side where Russia was sending bombers or any kind of aircraft into U.S. airspace. This was all sort of one-way street when it came to sending these eavesdropping missions.
Over a long period of time, it seems like the United States and the Soviet Union sort of came to an agreement on what the rules were. You know, if you do this, we'll do that. Don't do that. Is part of the problem that we're currently having with China, is that based on a new player who's reestablishing new sets of rules?
Well, I think it's a combination of reasons. I think one of the things is that the United States is doing this more frequently than it had in the past. And I think as a result, the Chinese are responding sort of in kind. The more flights we fly, the more harassment they want to give us. Again, just going back to the old days with President Eisenhower and sending these missions, he actually said in a National Security Council meeting at the White House at one point, after China shot down a very similar plane in 1956, killing 16 Americans, he said that he began questioning whether these flights are useful or not. And he said if we had a Chinese flight flying, a military flight flying between 20 and 50 miles off the U.S. coast, we would shoot it down, whether it was there accidentally or not. So it's a very dangerous game that gets played, and the problem here is you're sending these planes in virtually every day, and I don't think that intelligence is needed every day.
What we were told about in this most recent incident is they were very interested in two new destroyers, or new to China. These are old Soviet Sovremeny-class destroyers newly acquired by the Chinese, and that was what they were particularly interested in. Is there something on those ships, some sort of electronics or radar or something like that, that couldn't have been detected by U.S. satellites in space?
No. Any kind of information that they could get on that ship could be gotten in much less provocative ways. They have aircraft that fly much higher and much further away from the coast and can do it all in one pass. RC-135 rivet joint aircraft, for example. They're basically flying vacuum cleaners that could pick up any kind of signal.
But the provocation seems to be part of it. We'll provoke you, turn on your stuff, and we'll see what you got.
Well, that's always been part of the reason for these flights. That's the reason that they fly them so close a lot of times, is because that's the only time that the Chinese, or before that, the Russians, would ever turn on certain radar systems, as if a plane got close to the border. In the past, what would happen would be these planes would fly directly at the border and then turn away at the last minute. And sometimes they wouldn't turn away at the last minute. They keep on going 5 or 10 miles into the country and then come out again to turn on communication systems and radars that are normally left off.
The Russians preferred seagoing intelligence gathering platforms, the trawlers that used to trail behind every U.S. aircraft carrier battle group wherever it went, and sometimes parked off interesting places on the American coast. The NSA then mimicked that and developed a navy of its own.
That's right, but instead of trawlers, we used actual navy ships mostly. And smaller ships also, but we didn't really mimic the trawler, but we did mimic the seagoing platform.
The most famous of those two ships, again, connected with disasters, USS Pueblo and the USS Liberty.
That's right. The USS Liberty was sailing off the coast of the Sinai during the Six-Day War, and it was attacked by Israel. 36 Americans were killed and 171 were wounded, and the ship was virtually destroyed. The other one was the USS Pueblo that was sailing about 13 miles off the coast of North Korea when it was attacked and seized by the North Korean Navy and towed into port, and the crew was kept in prison in North Korea for 11 months. One sailor was killed in the initial attack.
There is almost a sense of, well, you know, to some degree, that's the price of the game if you're playing against North Korea and the Russians, if you're penetrating Soviet airspace or Chinese airspace. I think a lot of people will be outraged about an American ally who destroys an American ship.
That's right. That was actually the first ship attack was the USS Liberty, and it was an enormously violent attack. The ship was attacked by fighter aircraft. They fired about 800 cannon rounds into the ship. They dropped heavy bombs on the ship. The They came back again, and this time they dropped napalm all over the ship, turning it into a fiery cauldron at one point. They shot up all the antennas on the ship so that the ship couldn't communicate. They shot up all the small defensive machine gun. They only had a couple little machine guns on the ship, and they shot those up. And then once they were finished, torpedo boats came. Three torpedo boats came and fired a total of five torpedoes at the ship, which would have been enough to sink several aircraft carriers. Luckily, only one hit the ship, but that one that hit it was devastating, and it hit right in the eavesdropping spaces, the operational spaces, and it instantly killed 25 sailors, that one blast.
This was during the 1967 war in the Middle East. Israel has always said the ship was attacked by mistake, and one of the rationales you always heard about it was, you know, what possible interest did Israel have in attacking an American ship? It had to have been a mistake.
Well, I've looked into it quite extensively, and I've gotten a hold of a lot of previously very secret NSA documents, and there's a lot of questions raised about their mistake explanation. One point in this mistake report that they came out with, they said that the Liberty was going something like 30 knots or something. I mean, the ship had a total speed capability of something like 7 knots, and at the time it was only going between 3 and 5 knots, which means it was basically treading water. They said that they mistaked the ship for an Egyptian ship that was about half its size and had a very different profile than this ship. This ship was very distinctive because it had a lot of antennas on it, and it had a very large dish-shaped antenna. It was basically a satellite-type antenna on the back. In addition, it had its name in full English letters, not Arabic script, but English letters on the back saying USS Liberty. It had the ship's numbers is the way the U.S. ships put it on the side, not the way the Egyptians put it on. And in addition to that, it was flying the U.S. flag. So given all these factors, and the Israelis say they never saw a flag, and these are all the fighter pilots and all the members of the torpedo boat crew, it raises very serious questions as to the validity of the Israeli explanation.
So what do you think the reason was?
Well, at the time, the USS Liberty was sailing into a very hazardous area. The Israelis had launched the Six-Day War a couple days earlier. And what nobody knew at the time, until just recently, was that at that moment that the Liberty sailed off the coast of the Sinai, off a little town called El Arish, the Israelis were butchering prisoners, killing them with their hands raised and their hands behind their back.
Egyptian prisoners of war.
That's right, Egyptian prisoners of war and some civilians. They had no place to house the prisoners, and they didn't have a way to transport them, and so they decided the only way to handle the situation was to commit massive war crimes and kill them. And at that very moment, the Liberty, which was an enormous United States eavesdropping factory, was sitting only about 13 miles off the coast, fully capable of eavesdropping on what was going on the shore.
Our guest is James Bamford. He's the author of a new book titled Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. We're going to take a short break now. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan. Our guest is James Bamford. His book is titled Body of Secrets, and it's about the National Security Agency. The first soldier killed in the Vietnam War was James T. Davis. He was on an eavesdropping mission trying to collect Viet Cong radio signals. Your book, James Bamford, describes the American experience in Vietnam as a disaster from beginning to end.
Oh, that's right. NSA had a very large role in Vietnam. As a matter of fact, NSA played a very major role in the United States getting involved in Vietnam in the first place. Once again, there was an eavesdropping mission off the coast of North Vietnam. And once again, it was a routine eavesdropping mission in international waters. This time it was a U.S. Navy ship called the USS Maddox. And it was just cruising slowly up and down the coast, picking up communications and signals and so forth from the North Vietnamese Navy and military. But at the same time, the U.S. was launching very secret, very provocative attack missions along the coast. These were missions sponsored by the U.S., but carried out by the South Vietnamese. And these were very violent attacks on various coastal towns. The North Vietnamese assumed that the Maddox was directing these attacks because it was right off the coast at the time these were going on, and it was just sort of sitting there while these attacks were taking place. As a result, the North Vietnamese sent out a couple of PT boats to try to attack the Maddox at one point, and the Maddox managed to evade the attack. As a result, the U.S. Sent a escort, a destroyer to escort the Maddox called the Turn of Joy, USS Turn of Joy. So 2 days after that first attempted attack, the USS Maddox received a warning message from the National Security Agency saying, we received word that there may be an attack that may take place very soon. As a result of that, the people on both the Maddox and the Turn of Joy got very nervous and began looking for any sign of a possible attack, and they began seeing indications of torpedo boats coming and torpedoes being fired and so forth. As a result of this, the word got back to Washington that this was a violent attack on the USS Maddox and Turn of Joy. It became known as the Tonkin Gulf Incident. As a result of that, President Johnson pushed very hard for the United States Congress to pass a resolution basically declaring war, United States war against North Vietnam.
Gulf of Tonkin Resolution.
Exactly. It became the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which was passed almost unanimously.
One vote against it.
Exactly. And that basically launched the U.S. formally into the Vietnam War. It only came out years later that that initial message to the Maddox that they were about to be attacked was an erroneous message. It was a message that was meant to indicate the attack several days earlier that just got delayed and was received several days late by the Maddox. And the indications that the crew members saw on their radar scopes and so forth turned out to be basically just ghost images, that there never was this second attack.
And as the last strains of the last rendition of White Christmas went out over the air in Saigon in 1975 and the last helicopter lifted off the top of the U.S. Embassy and carried the last Americans to safety, what we didn't know was that an entire warehouse full of secret code equipment was left behind.
That's right. The U.S. had given the South Vietnamese government a lot of very expensive and very secret encryption equipment that would scramble their communications, for example. As it looked like Saigon was coming close to falling, the United States NSA basically put out the word that we wanted to get all this equipment back before it fell into communist hands. So the U.S. managed to get all the equipment back from the South Vietnamese, and they put it in a warehouse near the airport, and they were about to fly it out back to the United States. But before the flight could be arranged to fly the equipment back to the United States, the entire city of Saigon fell to the North Vietnamese, and the entire warehouse containing over 700 pieces of NSA's most advanced crypto equipment fell into the hands of the communists, which then presumably was passed on to the Russians. So it was the largest compromise of crypto equipment in U.S. history.
Now, for several minutes now, we've been speaking almost of an unrelieved series of disasters. Clearly, the NSA did a lot of things right.
Oh, of course. The NSA, I think, was probably the most important intelligence agency during the Cold War in terms of being able to find out what the Russians are doing and find out advance warning of what they might be planning and so forth. The U.S. had a very great capability to build technical means for eavesdropping on Russian communications, from satellites to ground-based listening posts that basically circled the Soviet Union. And although we had sort of stumbled at the beginning, we managed to, I think, do fairly well in the code-breaking area. But the Russians were always better at human spies, and a lot of times they negated what NSA was able to do by planning, by having Americans who volunteered to spy for the Russians give away some of the NSA secrets.
James Bamford's book about the National Security Agency is titled Body of Secrets. We'll continue our conversation in the next half of the show. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross. Now, more of my conversation with author James Bamford about his new book about the National Security Agency, Body of Secrets. NSA was formed as an amalgamation of the signal intelligence services that broke the German and Japanese codes so famously now in the Second World War. Encountering the Soviet Union, though, they had a very different experience. First, though, you report they had a tremendous break right after the end of the Second World War, but after that, very difficult to break Russian codes.
That's right. During World War II, the U.S. and the Allies had the biggest successes probably in the history of cryptology, where they were able to break the high-level cipher systems of both of our main enemies, the German Enigma cipher machine and the Japanese Purple machine.
Also, the Japanese naval codes, JN-25, which was hugely important.
That's right. There were a number of different code systems. We had broken the Purple code, actually, just right at the very beginning of the war. So we were very lucky in having broken the high-level encryption systems of both Japan and Russia during the course of most of the war. But during that period, the United States and Russia were allies in fighting the Germans. And as a result of that, the U.S. spent no time trying to break any Russian code systems or else trying to eavesdrop on Russian crypto systems. So as a result of that, when the war ended and the U.S. began the Cold War, the U.S. was in a very difficult position because we were suddenly faced with this brand new adversary, and we hadn't even begun to try to break these encryption systems. However, there was some very wise planning at the end of World War II by both the United States and Britain. What they did was they formed a group of cryptologists known as TICOM, which stood for Target Committee. And as the war was coming to an end, the United States wanted these cryptologists to get in there and steal as much German code equipment as possible, and also capture as many German cryptologists as possible. And the reason for this was we wanted to know what the Germans knew about breaking Russian codes, because we knew that the Germans had been doing that during the war, even though we hadn't. And at the same time, a second reason for this TICOM was to try to find out how vulnerable our own encryption systems were. For example, we wanted to know whether the Germans were able to break any of our high-level codes, because if they were, we certainly wanted to correct that problem before we got into this new Cold War with Russia. And the U.S. had a major breakthrough in finding some German cryptologists who led them to a enormous machine. It filled up four 10-ton trucks. This is an enormous code-breaking machine that was buried in the ground in front of one of the German buildings. And these German prisoners led them to the machine. They dug it up, and it managed to break high-level Russian codes. So it was the biggest...
Right then and there, just spat out, you know...
That's right, because they set it up right there at the building, and the Germans, who had actually been working on the machine, got it working again. So the U.S. packed it up on these 10-ton trucks and sent the machine and the German codebreakers over to England, where they set it up and began breaking Russian codes. And a duplicate of that machine was sent to the United States, and we began working on Soviet codes over here also. So that was a very big boon for the United States. The second half of TICOM, to try to find out what they knew about the U.S. codes, was also successful because we found out that the Germans were never able to break any high-level U.S. codes. Unlike our breaking their codes, their high-level Enigma and so forth, they were never able to break virtually any U.S. code except for a couple of naval codes, low-level naval codes. The U.S. and Britain have still kept under wraps virtually all details concerning TICOM. So it's pretty much the last great secret of World War II.
Now, this piece of German-Russian equipment that broke the Russian codes, you write that it was eventually compromised, people think, by a spy. Obviously not the first and not the only spy to compromise the secrets of the National Security Agency. We're most familiar, I guess, with the Walker spy ring, which did terrible damage to the United States. And you quote KGB officials, former KGB officials, about the importance of the key codes that John Walker's spy ring supplied to the Kremlin, but also Aldrich Ames, and most recently, of course, Robert Philip Hansen. Cumulatively, the damage that all of these human spies of the Soviet Union caused must have been tremendous.
Well, it is tremendous. I don't think many people realize how thoroughly the United States was penetrated during this period. For example, the John Walker spy case was enormously damaging, more damaging than most people realize, because in order for the Russians to break U.S. High-level encryption systems, they need two things, basically. They need the key cards, which are basically, at that time, they were IBM-type cards.
And punch cards, yeah.
That's right, punch cards. And they'd be put into a machine, a crypto machine, and then the cards would tell the machine what settings, basically, to set the machine at. And the cards would be changed every day. So you need two things, basically. You need the cards that change the ciphers in the machine, and you need the machines themselves. Well, John Walker in the late 60s began passing regularly all the high-level Navy, U.S. Navy key cards to the Russians. But they were just the key cards. They didn't have the machines. But then, a few months after Walker began giving the cards to the Russians, that's when the North Koreans captured the USS Pueblo. And when they captured the Pueblo, they gave the some of the machines they captured off the Pueblo to the Russians. So the Russians at that point, beginning around January of 1968, had both the key cards and the machines. So they were able to break the high-level U.S. Navy encryption system and thereby read all the messages to and from U.S. Navy ships and submarines all throughout much of the world.
Is there any indication from your talks with former KGB officials of what the Russians were able to do with this goldmine of information?
Well, they were able to keep an eye on exactly where U.S. Navy ships and, to a large degree, U.S. Navy submarines were operating during this period, because they had access to the highest classification messages, top secret messages, indicating where the ships were supposed to go, where they're operating, how they're operating, what kind of armament they had on them, what the plans were for the next 6 months or the next year or whatever. So for more than a decade, close to two decades, the Russians had this information. The Navy didn't detect John Walker until the mid-1980s when he was finally arrested. And Walker not only gave everything he could get to the Russians, he had his son, his brother, and his best friend, Jerry Whitworth, also passing him information that would eventually go on to the Russians.
You're almost tempted to think that after all of that was disclosed to Moscow, and throw in Aldrich Ames and Hansen as well, how did the Russians lose? I mean, maybe this wasn't as important as we all thought it was.
Well, that's the question. You never know it at the time how important intelligence is going to be, and you don't have a crystal ball, so you can't see into the future, so you've got to handle intelligence as well as you can at the time. But looking back at it, intelligence played a very little role in terms of the entire collapse of the Soviet Union. It collapsed internally because of economic reasons and very poor planning and just a badly managed and very corrupt government system. But unlike World War II, where intelligence played a key role in the winning of World War II against both Germany and Japan, intelligence in the end did not play a major role in terms of the United States winning the Cold War.
More with James Bamford on the National Security Agency after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
James Bamford is our guest. His book is Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. The World War II alliance between the United States and Britain, which cracked the Nazis' Enigma code, has survived to form an organization called the UK-USA Partnership. It's expanded to include other countries. You write, in 2001, the UK-USA partners had become an eavesdropping superpower with its own laws, its own language, and its own customs. Its goal, you say, is to rule cyberspace. Now, that sounds a little ominous.
Well, it's basically the major English-speaking countries of the world, and these countries got together during World War II and were very successful in breaking the German and Japanese codes, and they've continued the partnership ever since. Right after the war, they entered this UK-USA agreement and joined the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK into this very secret partnership whereby each country would have a sphere of influence or a sphere of eavesdropping capability.
And it's coordinated by a system called Echelon. Tell us about that.
Well, Echelon is basically it's sort of a software type system that enables the U.S., like a search engine, for example. If we're interested in information on what's happening in Vietnam, for example, the Australians might be able to pick that up. But through Echelon, we're able to exchange information and give information back and forth among the different countries. It's basically a cyber sharing, signals intelligence sharing operation.
And in the news in the last few years, because of concerns in Europe, both about industrial espionage and about personal privacy.
That's right. The Europeans, who have always been very interested in issues of privacy, have been very concerned about the capability of this massive worldwide eavesdropping system. There's been a lot of speculation that the system is being used by the United States and its UK-USA partners to eavesdrop on corporations in Europe and then use that information for economic espionage, for competitive espionage. In other words, to eavesdrop on the French Airbus company and pass on contract information, future plans to Boeing in the United States. This is my second book that I've written on NSA, and I've spent a lot of time talking to people inside the government, outside the government, and a lot of different areas. I haven't found any indication that NSA does do this sort of competitive economic intelligence. They don't go out and steal from Airbus to pass on to Boeing, for example.
Are concerns about personal privacy better founded?
Personal privacy is a different matter. It's a very difficult issue. In the United States, the U.S. has a certain law. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that protect the U.S. citizens, even if NSA accidentally picks up their communications. They're supposed to take their name out of the communication and substitute an American citizen or some other generic name. But that protection stops with American citizens, and it basically stops at the border. One of the caveats in this rule, this law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, is if the NSA picks up information and it indicates that the person is involved in a crime, regardless of whether it's an American, NSA not only has a right, but it actually has a duty to turn that information over to U.S. law enforcement. And that's where NSA gets into a lot of gray areas with U.S. law enforcement, especially in the drug area. NSA's was set up principally to eavesdrop on foreign intelligence. In other words, information outside of the United States in foreign countries. But when you start getting into the drug area, that's where you start getting into some very questionable areas, because when you're intercepting communications dealing with Colombians talking to Colombians in Colombia, that may not be a problem. But when the Colombians start talking to Americans, and then the Americans start talking among themselves, where do you draw the line? The DEA is continually trying to push the envelope to get NSA to do more and more drug enforcement eavesdropping, and NSA is continually trying to back away from getting heavily involved in U.S. law enforcement. So it's a gray area, and it's an area that the public has very little ability to see what's going on.
I guess the case that is probably best remembered involves the brother of the then president of the United States.
That's right. It was a scandal called Billygate. Billy Carter was the president. Was the brother of President Jimmy Carter, and Billy Carter got involved with the Libyan government, basically trying to help them get sales or get some kind of help from government organizations and so forth. And in essence, he became an agent of the Libyan government. However, he never registered as an agent, so he was breaking the law by acting as an unregistered agent of the Libyan government. At the time, the NSA was eavesdropping on almost every communication going in and coming out of Libya. So during the course of this eavesdropping on Libya, NSA picked up indications that Billy Carter was acting as a unregistered agent of the Libyan government. NSA turned that information over to the Attorney General Civiletti, I think it was, and there was a large investigation, and I guess portions of it leaked, and it became the Billygate affair. But that's one example of NSA eavesdropping on a foreign communications, picking up a U.S. citizen's communications, and all of a sudden NSA is involved to some degree in domestic law enforcement.
In a minute, the conclusion of our conversation with James Bamford about his new book, Body of Secrets, and the National Security Agency. This is Fresh Air.
James Bamford's first book on the National Security Agency came out almost 20 years ago. It was Puzzle Palace. He has a new book out, Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. Throughout our conversation, we keep referring back to spies. You know, this one destroyed this system, that one provided this crucial piece of equipment or information to the Soviet Union. As it turned out, you were a friend of a man who turned out to have been a longtime Soviet mole, and that's Mr. Hansen, of whom we've read so much.
That's right. Of course, when I knew him, he was a senior official with the FBI associated with foreign intelligence. I mean, he was a counter-spy. He was the guy looking for the other spies. And I got to know Bob Hansen quite well during the 1990s, and we'd see each other, have lunch together, and go out different places together occasionally on social activities. We had a mutual friend. I had a friend at the CIA who actually introduced me to Bob Hansen. So I actually have quite a few FBI friends and friends in the intelligence community, which is why I was able to write Body of Secrets and so forth. So it came as a shock more to me than almost anybody else, I think, with a few exceptions, I guess, that he turned out to be arrested for espionage. Matter of fact, the day I read the article, I saw the article headline, headline saying major spy arrest, and in the corner of my eye I saw Bob Hansen's name, and I immediately thought that, oh, terrific, you know, he's finally made a huge spy arrest, which is the ultimate goal for all FBI
counterintelligence
agents, and very few of them ever do make an arrest during an entire career because there's so few spies and there's so many FBI counterintelligence agents. So I thought, well, great, he just made the rest of his career. Well, it turned out to be the rest of his career, but it wasn't he that was making the arrest. So I was very, very surprised and astounded that that he could do that. Matter of fact, he seemed, as most people have said, to be the complete opposite of the typical spy. He wasn't flashy with money. He never had any great desires to have sports cars or any kind of other material goods.
Was he a source?
He was a personal friend of mine. I don't talk about sources. I just don't. But he was certainly a personal friend of mine. He attended my wedding. We've gone sailing down the Potomac together. So he was a friend of mine.
You say you don't talk about your sources. If Bob Hansen was indeed a source, don't you think he's sort of violated that agreement by lying to you all along?
Well, that may be, but I don't have caveats in there for people who violate agreements or whatever. It's just a policy I've always had. There's no need to talk about sources. I mean, I don't have any need to. I've got a lot of friends.
Well, in retrospect, looking back, if this guy gave you some information, don't you want to go back and say, well, you know, I might want to look at it in a new light now?
Well, if he did give me information, I probably would go back and look at it in a new light. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be talking about it publicly, but I was the investigative producer for ABC for a long time. I developed a lot of friends in the government, and a lot of these friends are just plain friends. I mean, some of them help and some of them don't, and it doesn't mean that I'm not going to not be friends with somebody if they don't help me occasionally. So, you know, he fits into the category of being somebody who was a friend of mine here, and whether it ever went beyond that, I just can't say.
If you get a chance to talk to him, and presumably once his legal problems have resolved one way or another, may involve a trip out to the cell over from John Walker's to ask him, but what's the first thing you would ask him?
Well, if he was found guilty, the first question I'd ask would be, why did you do it? Or what prompted you? What was your motivation? What was it you were getting out of it? Because it didn't seem to be that he was doing it for money initially, at least not back in 1985. That didn't seem to be the number one reason. With a lot of the spies, and like I said, I've interviewed a great many of them, and it's not very complicated. I mean, John Walker wanted a lot of money. He wanted to buy a boat. He wanted to buy a plane. He wanted to buy lots of things. Aldridge Ames walked into a bank with $500,000 in his briefcase to buy a house for cash. With Bob Hansen, if he is found guilty, the question would be, if it wasn't for money, what was the reason? And, I mean, he's made some oblique references in some of his writings that were picked up by the FBI, writings to the KGB, indicating that he'd long had an admiration for Kim Philby, who was the infamous British spy who was a double agent for the Russians. And he'd been wanting to do this since he was 14 and so forth. So it may be, and he wouldn't be the first one, but it may be for the thrill of it. There are people who are sort of addicted to intrigue, and there are a fair number of spies that have been caught that was the motivating factor, was this desire for intrigue. And, you know, Bob joined the FBI, which is sort of an intriguing agency, and within the FBI he joined the counterintelligence, the spy hunters of the FBI, which again is another sort of intriguing element. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, and I have no idea. But it'd be a very interesting conversation if number one he did do it, and number two he admits why he did it.
James Bamford, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Neil. Thank you.
James Bamford's new book is Body of Secrets, An Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency.